Chapter 10. He was always a queer chap, Neve. Years older than you and me, of course, and even when I first knew him, in my raw Roman days, he gave me an extraordinary sense of age and experience. I don't think I've ever known anyone who was at once so intelligent and so simple. It's the precise combination that results in romance, and poor little Neve was romantic. He told me once how he'd come to Rome. He was originary of Mystic, Connecticut, and he wanted to get as far away from it as possible. Rome seemed as far as anything on the same planet could be, and after he'd worried his way through Harvard with shifts and shavings, the two, and I can't imagine he contrived to get sent to Switzerland as tutor to a chap who'd failed in his examinations. With only the Yelps between, he wasn't likely to turn back, and he got another fellow to take his pupil home, and struck out on foot for the Seven Hills. I'm telling you these early details merely to give you a notion of the man's idealism. There was a cool persistency and a headlong courage in his dash for Rome that one wouldn't have guessed in the little pottering chap we used to know. Once on the spot, he got more tutoring, managed to make himself a name for coaxing balky youths to take their fences, and was finally able to take up the more congenial task of expounding the antiquities to cultured travelers. I call it more congenial, but how it must have seared his soul. Fancy unveiling the sacred scars of time to ladies who murmur colon was this actually the spot, while they absently feel for their hatpins. He used to say that nothing kept him at it but the exquisite thought of accumulating the lyre for his collection. For the Neve collection, my dear fellow, began early, began almost with his Roman life, began in a series of little nameless odds and ends, broken trinkets, torn embroideries, the amputated extremities of maimed marbles, things that even the rag picker had pitched away when he sifted his haul. But they weren't nameless or meaningless to Neve. His strength lay in his instinct for identifying, putting together, seeing significant relations. He was a regular cuvier of bric-a-brac. And during those early years, when he had time to brood over trifles and note imperceptible differences, he gradually sharpened his instinct, and made it into the delicate and redoubtable instrument it is. Before he had a 1,000 francs worth of antique agli to his name, he began to be known as an expert, and the big dealers were glad to consult him. But we're getting no nearer the Don Diana. Well, some 15 years ago, in London, I ran across Neve at Christie's. He was the same little man we'd known, effaced, bleached, indistinct, like a poor impression as unnoticeable as one of his own early finds, yet, like them, with a quality, if one had an eye for it. He told me he still lived in Rome, and had contrived, by fierce self-denial, to get a few decent bits together piecemeal, little by little, with fasting and prayer, and I mean the fasting literally. He said he had run over to London for his annual hook round. I fancy one or another of the big collectors usually paid his journey, and when we met he was on his way to see the Daunt collection. You know old Daunt was a surly brute, and the things weren't easily seen. But he had heard Neve was in London, and had sent, yes, actually sent, for him to come and give his opinion on a few bits, including the Diana. The little man bore himself discreetly, but you can imagine his pride. In his exultation he asked me to come with him. I've the grands et petites entrées, my dear fellow. I've made my conditions, and so it happened that I saw the first meeting between Humphrey Neve and his fate. For that collection was his fate. Or, one may say, it was embodied in the Diana who was queen and goddess of the realm. Yes, I shall always be glad I was with Neve when he had his first look at the Diana. I see him now, blinking at her through his white lashes, and stroking his seedy wisp of a mustache to hide a twitch of the muscles. It was all very quiet, but it was the coup de foudre. I could see that by the way his hands trembled when he turned away and began to examine the other things. You remember Neve's hands thin, sallow, dry, with long inquisitive fingers thrown out like antennae? Whatever they hold, bronze or lace, hard enamel or brittle glass, they have an air of conforming themselves to the texture of the thing, and sucking out of it, by every fingertip, the mysterious essence it has secreted. Well, that day, as he moved about among Dunn's treasures, the Diana followed him everywhere. He didn't look back at her, he gave himself to the business he was there for, but whatever he touched, he felt her. And on the threshold he turned and gave her his first free look, the kind of look that says, "Ooh, or mine." It amused me at the time, the idea of little Neve making eyes at any of Dunn's belongings. He might as well have coquetted with the Kohinoor. And the same idea seemed to strike him, for as we turned away from the big house in Belgravia, he glanced up at it and said, with a bitterness I'd never heard in him, "Colin, good Lord. To think of that lumpy fool having those things to handle. Did you notice his stupid stumps of fingers? I suppose he blunted them gouging nuggets out of the gold fields. And in exchange for the nuggets he gets all that in a year, only has to hold out his callous palm to have that great ripe sphere of beauty drop into it. That's my idea of heaven, to have a great collection drop into one's hand, as success, or love, or any of the big shining things, drop suddenly on some men. And I've had to worry along for nearly 50 years, saving, and paring, and haggling and intriguing, to get here a bit and there a bit, and not one perfection in the lot. It's enough to poison a man's life." The outbreak was so unlike Neve, that I remember every word of it. Remember, too, saying in answer, "Colin, but, look here, Neve, you wouldn't take Don's hands for yours, I imagine?" He stared a moment and smiled. "H have all that, and grope my way through it like a blind cavefish? What a question! But the sense, that it's always the blind fish, that live in that kind of aquarium is what makes anarchists, sir." He looked back from the corner of the square, where we had paused, while he delivered himself of this remarkable metaphor. "Gee God, I'd like to throw a bomb at that place, and be in it looting." And with that, on the way home, he unpacked his grievance, pulled the bandage off the wound, and showed me the ugly mark it had made on his little white soul. It wasn't the struggling, stinting, self-denying that galled him, it was the inadequacy of the result. It was, in short, the old tragedy of the discrepancy between a man's wants, and his power to gratify them. Neve's taste was too exquisite for his means was like some strange, delicate, capricious animal that he cherished and pampered and couldn't satisfy. Don't you know those little glittering lizards that die if they're not fed on some wonderful tropical fly? Well, my taste's like that, with one important difference: if it doesn't get its fly, it simply turns and feeds on me. Oh, it doesn't die, my taste, worse luck. It gets larger and stronger and more fastidious, and takes a bigger bite of me, that's all. That was all. Year by year, day by day, he had made himself into this delicate register of perceptions and sensations as far above the ordinary human faculty of appreciation as some scientific registering instrument is beyond the rough human senses, only to find that the beauty which alone could satisfy him was unattainable, that he was never to know the last deep identification which only possession can give. He had trained himself, in short, to feel, in the rare great thing such an utterance of beauty as the Donna Diana, say 100 elements of perfection, 100 reasons why, imperceptible, inexplicable even, to the average artistic sense. He had reached this point by a long austere process of discrimination and rejection, the renewed great refusals of the intelligence which perpetually asks more, which will make no pact with itself of yesterday, and is never to be beguiled from its purpose by the wiles of the next best thing. Oh, it's a poignant case, but not a common one, for the next best thing usually wins. You see, the worst of Neve's state was the fact of his not being a mere collector, even the collector raised to his highest pitch of efficiency. The whole thing was blended in him with poetry, his imagination, and romanticized the acquisitive instinct, as the religious feeling of the Middle Ages turned passion into love. And yet it could never be the abstract enjoyment of the philosopher who says, colon, this or that object is really mine, because I'm capable of appreciating it. Neve wanted what he appreciated, wanted it with his touch and his sight as well as with his imagination. It was hardly a year afterward that, coming back from a long tour in India, I picked up a London paper and read the amazing headline. Mr. Humphrey Neve buys the Daunt collection. I rubbed my eyes and read again. Yes, it could only be our old friend Humphrey, an American living in Rome. One of our most discerning collectors. There was no mistaking the description. I clapped on my hat and bolted out to see the first dealer I could find. And there I had the incredible details. Neve had come into a fortune $2 or $3 million, amassed by an uncle who had a corset factory, and who had attained wealth as the creator of the mystic super straight. Corset factory sounds odd, by the way, doesn't it? One had fancied that the corset was a personal, a highly specialized garment, more or less shaped on the form it was to modify. But, after all, the Tanagras were all made from 2 or 3 molds and so, I suppose, are the ladies who wear the mystic super straight. The uncle had a son, and Neve had never dreamed of seeing a penny of the money, but the son died suddenly, and the father followed, leaving a codicil that gave everything to our friend. Humphrey had to go out to Eli's on the corset factory, and his description of that. Well, he came back with his money in his pocket, and the day he landed old Don went to smash. It all fitted in like a Chinese puzzle. I believe Neve drove straight from Houston to Don's house. At any rate, within 2 months the collection was his, and at a price that made the trade sit up. Trust old Don for that. I was in Rome the following spring, and you'd better believe I looked him up. A big porter glared at me from the door of the Palazzo Neve. I had almost to produce my passport to get in. But that wasn't Neve's fault. The poor fellow was so beset by people clamoring to see his collection that he had to barricade himself, literally. When I had mounted the state scallon and come on him, at the end of half a dozen echoing saloons, in the farthest, smallest redoubt of the vast suite, I received the same welcome that he used to give us in his little den over the wine shop. Well, so you've got her? I said. For I'd caught sight of the Diana in passing, against the bluish blur of an old verger just the background for her poised loveliness. Only I rather wondered why she wasn't in the room where he sat. He smiled. Why, yes, I've got her, he returned, more calmly than I had expected. And all the rest of the loot? Yes. I had to buy the lump. Had to? But you wanted to, didn't you? You used to say it was your idea of heaven, to stretch out your hand, and have a great ripe sphere of beauty drop into it. I'm quoting your own words, by the way. Neve blinked and stroked his seedy mustache. Oh, yes. I remember the phrase. It's true, it is the last luxury. He paused, as if seeking a pretext for his lack of warmth. See, the thing that bothered me was having to move. I couldn't cram all the stuff into my old quarters. Well, I should say not. This is rather a better setting. He got up. See, come and take a look round. I want to show you 2 or 3 things, new attributions I've made. I'm doing the catalog over. The interest of showing me the things seemed to dispel the vague apathy I had felt in him. He grew keen again in detailing his redistribution of values, and above all in convicting old Daunt and his advisors of their repeated aberrations of judgment. The miracle is that he should have got such things, knowing as little as he did what he was getting. And the egregious asses who bought for him were no better, were worse in fact, since they had all sorts of humbugging wrong reasons for admiring what old Don simply coveted, because it belonged to some other rich man. Never had Neve had so wondrous a field for the exercise of his perfected faculty, and I saw then how in the real, the great collector's appreciations the keenest scientific perception is suffused with imaginative sensibility, and how it's to the latter undefinable quality that in the last resort he trusts himself. Nevertheless, I still felt the shadow of that hovering apathy, and he knew I felt it, and was always breaking off to give me reasons for it. For one thing, he wasn't used to his new quarters, hated their bigness and formality. Then the request to show his things drove him mad. "Tee the women, oh, the women!" he wailed, and interrupted himself to describe a heavy-footed German princess who had marched past his treasures, as if she were inspecting a cavalry regiment, applying an unmodulated magnificence to everything from the engraved gems to the Hercules torso. "Not that she was half as bad as the other kind," he added, as if with a last effort at optimism. "Tee the kind who discriminate and say, 'I'm not sure if it's Podicillae or Selenae I mean, but one of that school, at any rate.'" ... And the worst of all are the ones who know up to a certain point. Have the schools, and the dates and the jargon pat, and yet wouldn't know a Phidias if it stood where they hadn't expected it. He had all my sympathy, poor Neve. Yet these were trials inseparable from the collector's lot, and not always without their secret compensations. Certainly they did not wholly explain my friend's attitude. And for a moment I wondered if it were due to some strange disillusionment as to the quality of his treasures. But no, the Daunt collection was almost above criticism. And as we passed from one object to another, I saw there was no mistaking the genuineness of Neve's pride in his possessions. The ripe sphere of beauty was his, and he had found no flaw in it as yet. A year later came the amazing announcement the Daunt collection was for sale. At first we all supposed it was a case of weeding out, though how old Daunt would have raged at the thought of anybody's weeding his collection. But no, the catalog corrected that idea. Every stick and stone was to go under the hammer. The news ran like wildfire from Rome to Berlin, from Paris to London and New York. Was Neve ruined, then? Wrong again, the dealers nosed that out in no time. He was simply selling, because he chose to sell, and in due time the things came up at Christie's. But you may be sure the trade had found an answer to the riddle. And the answer was that, on close inspection, Neve had found the collection less impeccable than he had supposed. It was a preposterous answer, but then there was no other. Neve, by this time, was pretty generally recognized as having the subtlest flair of any collector in Europe, and if he didn't choose to keep the Daunt collection, it could be only because he had reason to think he could do better. In a flash this report had gone the rounds, and the buyers were on their guard. I had run over to London to see the thing through, and it was the queerest sale I ever was at. Some of the things held their own, but a lot and a few of the best among them went for half their value. You see, they'd been locked up in old Daunt's house for nearly 20 years, and hardly shown to anyone, so that the whole younger generation of dealers and collectors knew of them only by hearsay. Then you know the effect of suggestion in such cases. The undefinable sense we were speaking of is a ticklish instrument, easily thrown out of gear by a sudden fall of temperature. And the sharpest experts grow shy and self-distrustful when the cold current of depreciation touches them. The sale was a slaughter, and when I saw the Daunt Diana fall at the wink of a little third-rate brocanteur from Vienna, I turned sick at the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.